So 1 Kings 13 records a great event in the life of Israel, and an event perhaps not as well known as, say, Elijah confronting the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, or Moses and the Israelites crossing the Red Sea, and the Red Sea then being brought by the Lord upon the pursuing Egyptians. But nonetheless, an event of great magnitude, great importance in the history of Israel. This then occurred at the time when the kingdom of Israel had been united under David and Solomon, had just been split. It had just divided. This, as we would have read in the previous two chapters, was something that occurred because of Solomon's sin. And the Lord then, through the prophet Ahijah, spoke and condemned Solomon for his wickedness, for his idolatry and so on, and prophesied then that after him, after his death, then the kingdom that had been united under David and Solomon would be divided into the two parts that we're familiar with. The southern kingdom of Judah would remain with David's descendants, and then the northern kingdom of Israel that would continue with the other 10 tribes, initially then under this king that we've just read of, Jeroboam the first, as he becomes known, Jeroboam the son of Nebat. And the context then is that the kingdom has been split, as I said, because of Solomon's sin. The Lord has prophesied it. Humanly speaking, of course, it was because of the folly, as we read in chapter 12, of Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. He did not listen to the wise advice then, as we read, of the older men. He listened to the foolish advice of his younger companions. And as a result then, he alienated Jeroboam, a powerful leader, Jeroboam's colleagues, and the largest part of the nation, who then abandoned him and appointed Jeroboam as their king instead. Now that seems to have been acceptable insofar as it went to the Lord. He had predicted this would happen, and in fact he had prophesied that it would happen, and he'd even said to Jeroboam that if he was like David, a man after his own heart, and if he therefore was faithful as David had been to the Lord, then he would have had his own kingdom with descendants after him. But of course he wasn't, was he? As we've read, when he became king, he set up this altar in Bethel. He also set another one up in Dan. He installed high priests and lower priests. He installed places, high places on hills all over the place, where these priests were to minister, where they were to offer sacrifices. And he even invented festivals, all of which were counterfeit, all of which were in imitation then of what was happening in Judah. Why? Well, because he feared then that if the Israelites in those 10 tribes kept going up to Jerusalem, the central place of worship, then of course they would go back to the house of David. If they kept going to Jerusalem and worshipping the temple there that Solomon had built, then he feared the political consequences, that these Israelites would no longer be allied to him. They would drift back and commit themselves to his rival kings then in Judah. So as a political move, he said, okay, I'll have a complete counterfeit religious system. And he set that up. And so this then is the context for the events then, the great events that we just read in 1 Kings 13, where the Lord then calls this prophet, we don't know his name, this anonymous man of God from Judah, to go and rebuke Jeroboam, to condemn him, to condemn his false religious system, his counterfeit worship, to condemn his kingdom. And so then, what I'd like us to focus then on this evening are two lessons to be drawn from this man of God, this anonymous prophet of the Lord. Firstly, to consider his great faith, and then to consider his great failure. His great faith and his great failure in the fight then of faith in the Lord's service. So first of all then, his great faith. And we're surely struck by this as we read then, as we have done, the events at the beginning of 1 Corinthians 13, aren't we? Here is a man then, confident, strong, bold in the Lord's service. And if we consider the circumstances, we see reasons, three good reasons why then he displays strong faith in the Lord. Firstly, there is the message that he had to bring. The message that he had to bring then to Jeroboam and those with him. In verse 2 of chapter 13 then we read, he cried out against the altar by the word of the Lord, O altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A son named Josiah will be born to the house of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places who are now offering, making offerings here, and human bones will be burned on you. Well, this is a pretty blunt message, isn't it? It's plain talking here. He comes up and he says, priests like this are going to be slaughtered themselves on these very altars, which could hardly be a clearer statement that this religious system was being condemned by God. And if that was enough, he said, then human bones would be burned. This was the greatest level of defilement, was to burn human bones, to have dead human carcasses being burned then on this altar. This was to condemn it in the strongest possible terms. For an Israelite, the uncleanest things were going to be burned on this altar. So this man then has to come and he has to proclaim this message of judgment, this message of blunt, plain condemnation of Jeroboam and all those priests and officials standing with him before this prophet as he speaks. So he had then this bold and unpopular message, and we are reminded, if you read through the history of the church, but we've been reminded even in recent times, of the unpopular elements in the gospel. That time after time, through the ages then, it is easy to want to trim and to make light and easier and more acceptable the gospel. To have a gospel of love, which is not biblical love, because of course it's removed the element of wrath and sin and condemnation. That without sin, without condemnation by the holy God, as we have sung, of our sin, there is no real gospel at all. That the true gospel of Jesus Christ is unpalatable naturally to people because it is a gospel that says people are sinners in need of a saviour, and that as sinners then we will be condemned by this just and holy God. And so again in these times we have then prominent men proclaiming as evangelicals a diluted, when we say a perverted, a castrated gospel that removes wrath and wants to smooth it and make it easy and palatable and acceptable. And whether a man calls himself an evangelical, whether he calls himself a liberal, a Catholic, a Protestant, doesn't matter, does it? What matters is the message that he proclaims. We don't proclaim, as this prophet here didn't proclaim, condemnation and wrath because we think it's an easy thing to do or because it makes us feel good. We do it because, like this man, we want to be faithful to the Lord. This man was faithful in the Lord's service. He proclaimed this unpopular message. But of course he did so in an extremely difficult situation as well, didn't he? He proclaimed this message in the most frightfully difficult of contexts. This day then was the day when this new religious system was being inaugurated. Jeroboam, this king, has set up this religious system. He's appointed all his false priests, these high places and so on. And now he set aside this day, as we read at the end of chapter 12, as the great festival day. And he's gathered then the religious leaders. He's gathered all his political leaders that are all standing before him, the king, as he is about to make this sacrifice. As you picture them there, this king, Jeroboam, a powerful man, a charismatic and strong leader of men, with his other leaders who had overthrown the house of Solomon. And he stands before them then, this prophet, and he proclaims this message. A very, very difficult thing to do, wasn't it? And we see then, and we admire the strong faith then, the confidence that this man has in the Lord. that in the face of this difficult opposition, he speaks faithfully for the Lord. This, where I am today, is one of the easier positions to preach the gospel. It isn't difficult to stand here and preach wrath and sin and the gospel to you here, because most of you here know these truths and so on. This is not a place of the kind of opposition at all that this man of God had, is it? What's difficult is to speak this same gospel to people in your family who are in opposition to God. What's difficult is to preach this gospel in your workplace to people who are alien and hostile to the Lord. And if we're going to be like this man of God, then strong, faithful in God's service, we need to be not just proclaimers of truth here to one another, but in these much more difficult situations where we have that opposition. This man was faithful in his message, and he was faithful in this difficult context. And of course, thirdly and finally, he was faithful against this powerful man. I've reminded you briefly of what a strong and mighty king this Jeroboam was. And of course, he responds as you would expect, doesn't he? He reaches out his arm. He wants to strike this prophet dead. And the Lord intervenes. The Lord protects his man, doesn't he? The king reaches out his arms to condemn him, to have him struck down dead, perhaps to have him seized so he can slay him himself with his sword. We don't know how he wanted to strike him down, but he certainly did. But the Lord then shrivels up this king's arm. It withers in his sight as God intervenes again miraculously to protect his faithful prophet. So he knew what he was up against, this man, a violent leader in an intimidating context with a message of condemnation. And so for all these reasons then, we admire the strong faith of this man of God. And we see here then what we want to imitate in this man, to be strong in the Lord's service, as this man was strong in the Lord's service. And God honoured him. He protected him by shriveling up Jeroboam's arm. So much so that Jeroboam ends up pleading with him to restore him and even inviting him back to his own house. So we have then the great faith to imitate of this man of God. But then sadly we have his great fall or his great failure following this, don't we? In the first 10 verses we have his great faith, and we read this, we consider these sort of truths I've been showing you, and we admire this man. And then we read on and we have this tragic failure as his faith fails him. How could he fall so easily? How could he fall so quickly, having been so strong, so confident, so bold in the Lord's service? How could he now fail the Lord so badly? For as we've read, he leaves there in this intimidating situation. He's making his way back to Judah on some road. He's approached by an old man who invites him back, and he's enticed. He goes and he's condemned then in that prophet's house. And on leaving that, he's struck down dead by the Lord because of his transgression. So how then could he fall so quickly? And it's difficult, every time I read this chapter, it's difficult not to think of Paul's words to the Corinthians, isn't it? In 1 Corinthians 10, where he says, "Be careful if you think you are standing, so you don't fall." Be careful if you think you're standing, so you don't fall. Well, this man, he was standing so strongly, wasn't he? So boldly. And then he fell so suddenly. So I'd like to just draw then 6 lessons we can learn from this man's sudden fall into disobedience. 6 lessons grouped into 2 lots of 3. First of all, consider his general state then. His general state at the time of his failure. Firstly, he was tired. Physically, he was tired, as we read in verse 14. We find him now sitting down, resting under an oak tree. And we can understand why he was tired, can't we? He's come up on presumably a reasonably long journey from wherever he started in Judah. riding along on his donkey. He's not been able to eat and drink. But more than that, he's had the tremendous stress of this combat with King Jeroboam. He's had to prepare himself. He's had to stand before this opposition. He'd been under tremendous pressure then in that situation. He's been faithful and strong in the Lord's service, but this has drained him. We can understand why this has drained him. He's resting now on the way back. And now, of course, he falls. It's a vulnerable time, isn't it, when you're tired, when you're worn down, when we're healthy and strong and fit and able and so on, we can be much more easily strong, but we're physical creatures. And if our body is frail, if our body is tired, then we're vulnerable, as this man was. And so we need to then guard ourselves, don't we? We need to be aware that at the end of a day, a hard day at work, we're vulnerable. That then we can shout and be angry in a way we would not have done in the morning when we were fresh and fit and ready. We need to guard ourselves and be aware then, as physical creatures, that the weakness of our physical body can make us prey to Satan's temptations and fall then into sin. Secondly, of course, pride goes before a fall, as we read in Proverbs chapter 16. Pride goes before a fall. Now, we don't know that this man was proud, but it would certainly have been a danger for him, wouldn't it? Having been then so strong in God's service, having accomplished, it would seem, the mission God had given him to do, he now falls. He's vulnerable perhaps because he was thinking, I've done it. I've finished. I've achieved what the Lord gave me to do. And he perhaps then thought he'd achieved it in his own strength, and he forgot to rely, as he perhaps had been and should have been, on the Lord. John Bunyan's recorded as saying that he had been preaching then in a pulpit, and he had felt the Lord's unction, he felt the Lord's blessing upon him, and he had come down from the pulpit and somebody came up to him and said, Mr. Bunyan, that was a great sermon. To which Bunyan replied, yes, I know the devil told me that on the way down the steps. He was aware then of the danger of having seemingly done something well in God's service. He would then be vulnerable through pride lifting him up. And so he was keen to guard against that temptation, to sin in that time. And perhaps this man then failed in that. He was certainly physically tired. There was a danger of pride. But thirdly, he was psychologically vulnerable, wasn't he? He was psychologically vulnerable. As he had rode on his donkey up from Judah, he would, I think, have been much in prayer. After the Lord had commissioned him, he would have been, I think, fervently praying, as Mike was telling us this morning, that's so important for a man and woman of God. Even as he rode along his donkey, as I say, to pray, to call upon the Lord, as he knew what he had to do, as he faced this great challenge, he was aware of his complete dependency on God. And so he prayed. He prepared himself. He rested on the Lord. But having done the job, as it were, having completed, it would seem, his work, and he was riding his donkey back again, was he still praying? Was he still calling out to the Lord? Was he still aware then that he was in the ongoing fight of faith? Was he still aware that he was vulnerable to assaults and temptations? Or had he perhaps, having then carried out this great work for the Lord then, as I say, relaxed his guard because he was so psychologically vulnerable, having thought the job was done, he was caught off guard? Like a boxer in the ring then, ready with his guard up, fighting. Then the bell rings and he drops his guard, and his opponent whacks him and fells him to the floor. Because the devil doesn't, of course, play by the rules. The fight goes on. It didn't finish for this man of God when he left Jeroboam. His service for the Lord continued. And we have our highs and our lows. We have our times, don't we, when we're aware that there's a particular pressure on us, a particular duty the Lord is calling us to that may be tough. And we prepare ourselves, and we ought to prepare ourselves and be ready and seek the Lord and lean on him. But we need to continue to lean on him afterwards. I've wondered this afternoon in thinking of this about our building project and thought, well, we'd come so far. And we've been blessed with the money and we thought we were there. We thought we were there with the planning permission, the money, we'd made our decision, we'd done the detailed analysis, we'd committed everything to the outside agent for the detailed architectural plans and so on. And things are unfolding, it seems. And I wondered whether we're still praying. Are we still committing this work to the Lord? Or have we been caught, perhaps, as a church off our guard? Are we perhaps relaxed then in our prayers and commitment for this particular aspect of our church life at this time? It's very easy then at sometimes to think, yes, I need the Lord, but then when the challenge is finished, to forget that we still need the Lord. It's less obvious and we can be caught psychologically off guard. So I think the general state then of this prophet, his physical tiredness, the danger of pride and being psychologically off guard because he thought the work was done, all this then made him vulnerable to sinning as he did, to falling so badly on his face as he did on this occasion so tragically. But then secondly, consider the specific temptation that was brought to him, the way this temptation came. Firstly, of course, it was aimed at a vulnerable point, wasn't it? It was aimed at a weakness. Here he is, hungry and thirsty, and so this prophet, this old man comes and says, I've got food and drink for you. It's a vulnerable point for him. The devil knew then where to aim his arrow, as it were, of temptation. To a hungry and thirsty man, an exhausted, tired, travelling prophet, he says, have some food, have some drink, refresh yourself. And the Puritans then, if you've read any Puritan literature, you know that they emphasise the need to know ourselves, to be aware of our own weaknesses, our own vulnerable points. What are our particular bosom sins, as they called them? Those things, those sins we particularly incline to, that we particularly need to guard ourselves against. Not just occasionally, but perpetually, to be on our guard. To be aware then of where Satan knows he can most easily fell us in the Lord's service. Here he went specifically then for where he knew this man was weak and vulnerable. But secondly then, the temptation, the form of the temptation, it came then through a prophecy, didn't it? It came through this revelation from God, apparently. But of course, as we read very clearly here, it wasn't a true revelation from God. In verse 18, the prophet says to this man, I too am a prophet as you are, and an angel said to me by the word of the Lord, bring him back with you to your house, so that he may eat bread and drink water. And as if we needed telling, the author, the prophet, spells it out. But he was lying to him. We don't need telling because we've already read that God had told this man that he was not to eat bread or drink water through his whole time in Judah. On this whole expedition the Lord had called him on, this whole service, he wasn't to touch bread or water. So he should have known that this was a false prophecy, that this man was lying to him. But he didn't. Because if somebody comes up to you and says, an angel of the Lord has told me to say to you, well, that can sound pretty impressive, can't it? An angel of the Lord. It wouldn't sound quite so impressive if he went and said, oh, a demon has said to me. You're not going to fall for that. If he came to you and said, well, I think, you're not going to fall for that. But an angel of the Lord, a revelation from God, a word of the Lord. Ah, now there can be something that can tempt you in a way then that these other things would never do. The message is exactly the same. But the way in which the message is presented is different, and importantly different. Now, perhaps we're not, in this particular congregation, I think, so vulnerable to this kind of message. I know an evangelical church in Manchester where the pastor preached from 1 Timothy on male headship and eldership for men, as men. And a few weeks later, a prophetess stood up in the congregation and declared that the Lord had said that he wanted female elders in the church. And soon afterwards, there were female elders in the church. Now, we're not, I think, prey, I hope, to that particular kind of temptation, but these things can happen. The way in which a message is presented can beguile us, as it did this man here. He knew. Remember, he has just confronted Jeroboam, and Jeroboam has said to him, come and eat bread and have water with me. Come and eat with me. From Jeroboam, it wasn't a temptation, was it? But as a prophecy, so-called, dressed up as a message from the Lord, dressed up as something given by an angel, then he was deceived. So we need to be on our guard. But thirdly and finally, the message came from a man who claimed to be a believer. I'm going to say Christian, be slightly anachronistic. A believer in the Lord, didn't it? The man comes and says, I'm a prophet like you. I'm a prophet like you. It didn't have any hold on him when it came from an obvious pagan idolater like Jeroboam. From a wicked man like him, no problem. But here now, from a fellow believer, the same temptation strikes home so disastrously, doesn't it? Satan can speak through Christians or apparent Christians. When you read this chapter, we don't quite know what status this man has. He's a rather ambiguous character, isn't he? This old prophet. Is he a true man of God, or is he a true prophet? I don't know. And I don't think it matters, certainly for what we're considering today. The point is that he claimed to be a prophet. He claimed to be a man of the Lord, just like this man of God from Judah. And it was that claim that deceived him. It was the fact that the temptation came through him that brought him down. So when somebody, a pagan in your workplace, says to you, come on out for the night, come on out and have a few drinks and let's go to that club together. Well, that's not a temptation. You're on your guard. He's a pagan. That's not a problem. But when another Christian, maybe he's not a Christian, we don't know, but he goes to a church somewhere, and he says to you, come out with me for a few drinks, and maybe we'll go on somewhere. Well, that sounds okay, he's a Christian, isn't he? That's the problem, that's the danger, isn't it? The same temptation coming through a different person, in this case specifically someone claiming to be a servant of the Lord, can fail you. So the fact then that this man of God thought he was being led by another man of God so clearly contributed then to his fall so catastrophically into disobedience to God. He didn't listen to Jeroboam, but he fell when this man spoke to him. So we have then this tragedy, don't we? We have this man, this prophet of the Lord, so strong in God's service, so valiant, and then so tragically falling. We can learn lessons, as I've hoped to show you briefly this evening, from his strong stand in God's service. We need to learn lessons also from his tragic fall into sin. Vulnerable because of his physical tiredness, perhaps because of pride, psychologically off guard. But also because the temptation was aimed at a weakness in him, a vulnerable point. And it came as a false revelation through someone claiming to be a fellow man of God. Amen. So let's close with number 763. 763, we rest on thee, our shield and our defender. Number 763.